All right.
Okay.
Excuse me. So, and then finally, you know, we still believe that vegetated treatment is part of the solution, and that we need to have buffer strips, and that those buffer strips are part of the solution. It's not about nature and restoring nature. It's about having that vegetated treatment device, that vegetation between field and stream that is going to bring about, you know, reductions in nitrates. That's my presentation.
I'm going to take a break here. The food's here. 20 minutes.
Well, hang on a sec.
And we have the two other presenters.
Okay.
I'd suggest we go ahead and take the break, and they'd have their time.
Is that what we want to do? Is take a break? No, you don't. How about you or us?
What?
What? Mr. Johnston. The food is here. Do we want to break now? Do we want to finish with this group?
I can go either way. I can hold off and eat cold pizza and let them finish their presentation.
How much more time do they
have? Well, they have 32 minutes left.
Yeah. Which will go to 45.
Yeah. Can you just eat while they're talking?
Yeah.
While we eat? Is that okay with you guys?
You ordered for everybody, right?
Of course. Yeah. I don't mind that.
I don't mind doing that. Take a couple minutes and serve it up, and then we can...
You come back here?
Oh, you're so kind.
Is that okay?
That's what you want to do.
We're not in violation of anything in our permit, are we?
maybe Gary will get mad at it.
It gives us a little more time to get input, and this is valuable input, so I don't mind doing that.
I understand. Well, why don't we do this? Be careful if it's hotter. You do. Okay. Okay. All right. So we'll take a 5-minute break to just get our food back here, and then we'll continue with this. Okay? You can watch us eat. Okay. 5 minutes. We're not.
It's a good position that you for the video. I'm just going to camp right here. Get right up in your grill. Yeah, great. Oh, fantastic. Hey, I'm not honest? I would tell you.
You dance so
I wonder how that was.
I'm Sarah.
Oh, Sarah.
Nice
awesome.
To meet you.
Great to meet you. Yeah, indeed. Many times.
Nice to see you. Even though I'm sitting with the wrong people.
No. There are no signs.
Really? I know you're so sorry. You could go out. Just follow my Twitter feed. I'm good. I'm going to peel out of here, but I'll ask him.
I'm going to talk about process for 20 minutes. No. So you won't miss much.
But nice to meet you in person.
Absolutely.
Are you with
indeed. This is Ben Fitterly.
Sarah Rubin, Monterey County Weekly. Nice to meet you. Are you one of the plaintiffs?
Yeah.
Okay.
Very pleasant. Don't we have that decal or something?
The petitioner sticker? Yep. Somewhere.
Yeah, you know, it's some of these things you can tell. Am I on a microphone?
I'm going to go to the next one.
Yeah.
Can somebody tell Mr. Jeffries to come in from the dark, from the cold? He's outside talking to...
He's probably talking to the mayor so you don't get kicked out.
Well, he took care of that.
The mayor did, yes.
Yeah.
Well, the mayor wants to make sure you recognize Salinas has issues tomorrow.
There he is. Okay. All right. Okay, Mr. Schimmick. Who's next with your group? Okay.
Monica.
All right. Where's Monica?
She went to go get pizza.
She. Okay.
Hold on. We'll wait for Monica.
Hold on, Ben. We're going to wait for Dr. Hunter.
He's not too.
Hunter. Go ahead, Ben.
I'm Ben Pitterlander, the Watershed Programs Director for Santa Barbara Channel Keeper. I run most of our water quality monitoring programs, some of our advocacy work. Channel Keeper, we've been doing monitoring in our area since 2001, and we're very familiar with water quality issues in our area. I also served as a member of the original stakeholder panel that met from December 2008 to September 2009. And I followed this issue closely throughout the entire process and throughout the multiple drafts and revisions that have been made. And the purpose of our presentation today is to offer some perspective on how far we've come throughout this extended process and how much the proposal that staff has presented for adoption has been modified, largely to accommodate the agricultural industry. And what I'm going to do with my time here is to briefly do some comparisons of early versions of the order and the current draft and provide some examples from the area that I represent on what it's likely the new draft will mean for growers in our area. What I'll do is I hope some people realize just how far we've actually come and also realize how much agricultural communities' input has been incorporated. So this is our region. We're looking at the watersheds that drain to the Santa Barbara Channel, the ones that are on the south side of the San Ynez Mountains between Point Conception and the Ventura River. We don't have the scale of agriculture that you do here in the Salinas Valley, but we do have significant agriculture, mostly concentrated in the Goleta and Carpinteria areas. So the current draft is based on a three-tier system, and a useful comparison that continues to be made by staff and others is how the tier system compares to the existing 2004 order. And generally speaking, tier one is considered less stringent. Tier two is about the same, and we can expect that growers in tier three will have additional requirements compared to what they have today. So back in February, the original draft did not have a... exactly a tier one, but it did have a low-risk category, and I want everybody to look carefully at what it took to get into that category. So back in the original draft, growers had to eliminate all tailwater. If they were greater, and they also had to be greater than 1,000 feet from any impaired surface water body on the 303D list. Today, it's actually much, much easier to get into tier one. You don't need to eliminate your different tailwater, and that's a big difference. Today, you can't use chlorpyrifos or diazinone. You have to be 1,000 feet from some specific types of impaired water bodies. And then there's also a requirement that if you're growing high nitrate risk crops, you have to be less than 50 acres and more than 1,000 feet from a public well. We'll talk a little bit more in a moment about limiting requirements to high-risk crops. But Tier 1, remember, is less stringent than the 2004 order, and that's largely because there's no annual compliance form required, which is the same as there's no checklist required. And I'll give you an example in our area of what that might mean. I just want to clarify. The last time I did this, I got some questions. People thought I was petitioning the board to go out and find this specific grower, and that's not my intention here. This is an example of what generally these Tier 1 requirements So this is San Jose Creek. It runs from the foothills of the San Jose Mountains to the Galena Slough. It's considered one of the top priority streams for steelhead recovery in the region. And in fact, the city of Galena is currently spending millions of dollars on a steelhead passage retrofit project down at the bottom. The yellow mark there is our monitoring site. I think that may also be a state secant monitoring site. But if we look a little closely, you'll see upstream of the monitoring site is generally, it's basically entirely agricultural development. There isn't a lot up there. Now, these operations are not high-risk, high-nitrate risk crops. They're orchards. They're not within 1,000 feet of a nutrient, sediment, pesticide, toxicity, or turbidity-impaired water. And the first thing that I expect many growers to do is if they're using chlorpyrifos or diazinone, is that they'll likely try to switch pesticides to limit liability under the proposed program, which would effectively put this grower into Tier 1. So here's the problem. San Jose Creek might not be listed for those specific impairments, but it is listed for multiple impairments, and those are shown here. And these might not be the impairments that have been prioritized by the draft order, but we know it's salts, chloride, sodium, conductivity, are common agricultural contaminants. And we know that uncomposted or partially composted cow manure is a source of fecal bacteria. I'm not here to argue, again, whether this grower should be included in Tier 3 or not, but I'm saying if you use common sense and you look at this example, you look at the location of the monitoring site and the land uses around it, it's no stretch to assume that agriculture is likely contributing to some of these impairments. And I want you to remember, this isn't a discussion about requiring more of this type of operation. So what we're actually talking about is putting this operation in a tier that has even fewer requirements than they have today. And that's what the current staff proposal would likely do, we believe. And in order to do that, remember, without actually knowing the first thing about their actual practices, because at Tier 1 there's no checklist required, all we know for sure is that they don't use two specific pesticides. They don't use chlorpyrifos or diazinone. And it was enlightening in the staff proposal presentation earlier. They estimate that 55% of farms region-wide will likely be in Tier 1, and I wonder whether or not that Tier 1 estimation accounts for the group of growers who will likely switch pesticides and then to put themselves into Tier 1. I'm assuming it doesn't. So we look at a couple of the requirements. So individual discharge monitoring. Back in February, all discharges were required to do individual discharge monitoring. In September, or today, only Tier 3 growers are required. Milestones. Back in February, all dischargers were required to eliminate discharges to any water body to meet standards for toxicity, sediment, turbidity, nutrients, and salts. Today, only Tier 3 dischargers, are actually required to demonstrate through actual monitoring that they're achieving those milestones, and the percentage reduction has been reduced from 100% to 75% for turbidity and sediment, or sediment and nutrient loads. How do we know that the vast majority of growers are meeting these milestones? We won't. Nutrient management. Back in February, all discharges to any water body were required to include specific nutrient and irrigation management information in their farm plan. Under today's proposal, only Tier 3 dischargers with high nitrate loading risk must submit an irrigation and nutrient management plan. So a lot rests on this Tier 3 requirement, so I want to look closer at what it takes to get into Tier 3. So to get into Tier 3, you have to grow a high nitrogenous crop and be greater than 5,500 acres in farm size, or you apply chlorpyrifos and diazinon, and you discharge to a water body that's 303D listed for toxicity and pesticides. And that's a point I've heard many people overlook. It's not any 303D listed water body. It's these specific listings. So let's look at another example. This is a list of water bodies in our area that are officially impaired by either nutrients, those are the ones on the left with the N, or pesticides or toxicity on the right, which are obvious there. The first thing you'll notice if you tour our area, and you might notice by looking carefully at this background image, is we do not have a lot of high nitrate risk crops, at least as defined by this order. We have nutrient impairments, but most of the agricultural activity in our area is orchards, citrus and avocados, and they are not on that list. We do have some greenhouses, but they're regulated separately, and we have a small number of row crops. But again, if you look at this image, and if you know the area, we don't have farms that are that big. We don't have 500-acre row crop farms. So what does that mean for Tier 3 nutrient requirements in our area? It means we don't have any. I'd be willing to bet not a single farm will have Tier 3 nutrient requirements all the way from the Gaviota Coast to Ventura County. And that means there will be no irrigation and nutrient management plans and no nitrogen balance ratio targets for the entire area that I represent. Does that mean that our nutrient impairments will have been solved? No, probably not. But we still have pesticides and we have toxicity listings, so we should have some requirements. But again, what we feel is quite likely is that within 2 years, each grower along these toxic strains that's currently using chlorpyrifos and diazinon will probably work very hard to switch to a different pesticide to avoid liability and regulation. And as a result, we don't believe there will be any individual discharge monitoring in our area. Does that mean that our toxicity problems have been solved? No. Riparian buffers. This is an image of Carpinteria Creek. Back in February, all growers were required to have 50-foot buffers minimum. This is what it looks like in our area. Farmers grow right up to the top of bank. I'd say even most of these farms runoff gets piped right over the side into the creek. Today, in the current draft, only farms that are adjacent to sediment, turbidity, temperature, impaired water bodies must develop a water quality buffer plan. That's a buffer plan. It's very different than a 50-foot minimum buffer. So, again, let's see what that means. This is a list of all major water bodies in our area that have irrigated agricultural activities, and how many of these will be subject to the riparian buffer requirements based on the proposed order. One. And you'll notice that Carpinteria Creek, this creek here, is not on that list. So the idea that the board is taking these broad brush strokes, this blanket of regulation that's going to significantly affect the agricultural community at large, it's simply not accurate. In fact, the board staff has taken great pains to incorporate the concerns of the agricultural community into this draft. As much as they can do so and still meet legal requirements of the water code. And in my opinion, the proposed order swings even too far in the opposite direction to be effective. This draft has so many loopholes and is so selective in how it applies its protections that there will be large areas throughout the region that will not benefit at all from any additional accountability and enforceability that was originally intended. And that's how far we've come over the last 2 years, and that's where we're at today. And I think I'm going to leave it at that. Ready for it, Nathan?
Question for you. The kinds of farms that we have in Santa Barbara, we're talking about orchards?
Right.
Is there lemon orchards or avocados?
Citrus and avocados, citrus primarily.
How are they applying nutrients?
I believe some orchards... A lot of those guys in our area are actually on drip irrigation now, and they've been working with groups to implement good management practices. I do believe that there are some bad actors still, as evidenced by water quality conditions in certain areas. I couldn't tell you specifically how they're applying their nutrients.
Right. I'm just kind of wondering whether the in this area, farms would really be a significant contributor of nutrients, given their practices. I mean, we don't have green leafy vegetables. We don't have.
Right, I would say with confidence that they are indeed a contributor. If you look at the location of monitoring sites and you compare that to where there is agricultural activity and the type of impairments that exist, there's no doubt in my mind that there's agricultural contamination in our area.
I mean, from nutrients?
Correct.
And do you have any data?
Yes, the state has data.
You know, from above and below farming activity, these southern watersheds
right.
that would show.
There is data that shows that.
Do we have that?
We do have the data, and we've looked at the data, and actually it was a consideration because we did review Ben's comments from earlier drafts.
Right, right.
And
he's had these slides before,
right,
too.
Right, he's had these slides before. Right. And there is, in fact, impairments, and they are in agricultural areas, but when compared to the degree and severity in the Salinas and Santa Maria area, it really is not comparable. And so from...
Well, they may not be comparable, but if we have an impairment, doesn't that stand alone as something that needs to be corrected?
It is, and we can look at that on that basis with specific operations in specific areas. But in terms of, I'm applying it to the tiering criteria that he's describing.
Right, but separate from that, I am concerned that if we have impairments for nutrients and we have farming activities nearby, some even adjacent to, how are we going to look at with this proposed ag order whether those operations are contributing to this impairment?
Basically the similar way we're dealing with those operations in the current order.
Which is what? Because they're not going to be Tier 3. They're going to be Tier 1 or Tier
2. Tier 1 or Tier 2. So they have to submit an electronic notice of intent, which actually includes a better way of collecting data information. So we're actually able to look at that very quickly, more quickly than we were able to look at it in the previous hard copy, which is why we're able to determine the numbers and the different tiers. So we can evaluate risk based upon the characteristics identified in the notice of intent, like acreage, like chemical use, whether or not they're adjacent to an impaired water body, or one goes through that area. And then for Tier 2, it would be the annual compliance form.
Now, you already have that information from the current order.
It's in the form of a management practice checklist. That's in hard copy right now.
Okay, but I mean, have you had a chance to review those to see whether you already have the data to make that evaluation?
As was described by even Ag earlier today, it is not the way we have the information in the management practice checklist is just not conducive to doing that sort of analysis. It's a checklist, as Mark described, Dr. Los Huertos, of what you plan to do. It's not a checklist of what you've actually done or whether or not is effective. The annual compliance form will allow us to be more effective and efficient in our reporting and our analysis of the data. In addition, it also asks better questions in terms of what do you plan to do, when are you, have you done it, and is it effective?
Okay. Thank you. All right. 20 minutes left.
Yeah, can I? While she pulls that up, good evening, Mr. Chair and board members. My name is Nathan Alley. I'm an attorney with the Environmental Defense Center in Santa Barbara, and as has been mentioned, I've been working with these other fine gentlemen and folks in the audience for several years now on this issue. As you will see in a moment, the title of my slideshow is Everybody Loves Talking About Process. And I actually wrote that as a rather flip comment because no one really likes it ordinarily. However, tonight, many people have talked about process. So what I'm going to try to do is enhance that discussion and not be terribly redundant. With that in mind, I am focusing primarily on our two new board members who are present this evening and trying to bring you all up to speed on our process to date. So thank you very much for bearing with me. I do not have any pictures in my slides. It's relatively boring. I would like to say that I had hair when we started this process, but I'd be lying about that. Okay, onward. So, I'm going to start from the very beginning. As has been mentioned before, we're here because of the state's Porter-Cologne Water Quality Act. That interfaces with the Federal Clean Water Act in several very important respects. However, not for the purposes of this discussion. Waste discharge, as we're determining it tonight, is regulated primarily, if not solely, by Porter-Cologne. So let's just throw federal regulation out the window for the moment. As you can see, under Porter-Cologne, any person discharging waste or proposing to discharge waste within any region that could affect the quality of the waters of the state must file a report of waste discharge with the appropriate regional board. Waste discharge requirements. Once the regional board has received that report, they must then prescribe requirements as to the nature of any proposed discharge or existing discharge. Essentially, they write a permit that says how you can discharge, what you can and cannot do. In the absence of a WDR, generally, waste discharges are prohibited in this state. I say that because conditional waivers, as we're all now very familiar with, allow an exception under state law. If you have a situation where a WDR is otherwise required, the regional board or a state board may determine that a waiver is necessary. And a waiver must be consistent with any applicable state or regional water quality control plan, and as I've bolded, also must be in the public interest. Additionally, and very importantly, a conditional waiver under state law may only be operative for 5 years, after which time it must be renewed or terminated. Monitoring requirements. Every waiver in the state of California is conditioned by the following. It must include water quality monitoring. Those monitoring results must be made available to the public. Now, here we get to the Central Coast Ag Waiver Program. Our first ag waiver, as you all know, was adopted in 2004. Now, if you add 5 years to that, it then expired in July of 2009. Since July of 2009, the ag waiver has been renewed, quote unquote, 4 times so far. Now a little bit of history. For 20 years, roughly from 1983 to 2003, agriculture on the Central Coast operated under an implied waiver. It was not very a formal process. However, there was legislation in 1999 which amended the Water Code and said that any waiver that existed on January 1st, 2000 had to expire on January 1st, 2003, then may be reconsidered and readopted. Prior to 2003, we had records indicating that water quality on the Central Coast was problematic. It was shown to be impaired by constituents such as pesticides and nutrients, which lent, as you can see in the words of the staff, urgency to the need to adopt additional requirements for irrigated operations. So, in 2003, the regional board convened a stakeholder panel. That panel met for about a year. They were able to come to a compromise solution, which ultimately became the 2004 Ag Order. Now, there are several things that you need to note there. One, as regional board staff forecast at the time, at the end of the first five-year process, July of 2009, it was anticipated that the program would be revised in some way, shape, or form. In fact, the 2004 order itself stated that in time, increased reporting and monitoring may be required in order to ensure that water quality is improving. One thing that's not on the slide that I would also mention, my organization participated in that 2003 stakeholder process. I was not there myself. But my understanding is that the compromise which was struck was a relatively delicate one. And there were some contentious issues, such as how to treat groundwater, such as when to impose individual monitoring, that were left on the table in 2004 with an expectation that they would be revisited at the end of the five-year term, i.e. in 2009. To rephrase, the compromise that was struck to give us the 2004 order was predicated on an understanding that that compromise would be reevaluated and changed in 5 years. During the five-year term of the order, many growers were able to demonstrate compliance. That's fantastic, and we want to give kudos to all the farmers who have improved their water quality. We also want to give kudos to the people that simply educated themselves for the need to improve their water quality, even if they haven't been able to take all the steps necessary to date. However, we have noted many times that while there were improvements in how people complied with the law, we were still seeing severe problems with water quality. That led the staff to anticipate the end of the first waiver and convene a second stakeholder process. We started meeting in December of 2008. Originally, we anticipated that we would meet monthly for about five meetings in order to give us time to revise the order by July 9th, 2009. Well, once April rolled around, we decided that we were making some progress in our negotiations, and we needed a little more time to work on the new order. And so with our blessing, pretty much everybody who was participating, the regional board renewed the 2004 order in 2009. I won't get into those bullet points because Steve already covered them. Suffice it to say, we were given very explicit direction in 2008 what would be coming down the pipeline in this new order. As I mentioned, the stakeholder panel met monthly. The order was renewed in 2009. However, at our September 22nd meeting, it was ultimately decided that the stakeholder process had run its course. We would all go back into our respective corners and submit individual comments to the staff as they prepared a draft order. Now, I want to interject something here. I have great affection and respect for Bob Martin. I met him through the stakeholder process, and I really enjoyed our interactions. I do, however, want to clarify something that he said earlier on the record. He described that September 22nd meeting as follows. We had met three times without regional board staff. The sense in the room was that they were actually an impediment to our conversations, and the environmental folks and the ag folks were going to get together in a closed room, kind of hammer out some details. We met three times, made great progress, came back at September 22nd, and were poised to present our negotiated thoughts to staff when we were informed by the ag folk that their constituents had reviewed the proposal and rejected it. Therefore, we never actually presented that quote-unquote negotiated proposal to staff because essentially the stakeholder process ended before we were able to do so. So, you know, Bob kind of made it sound like we presented this great compromise and then staff rejected it. That's not really what happened. What we did was, as I said, we went back into our... Mr. Chair.
Are you saying that no proposal was presented?
We had a long-running and constantly evolving conversation which ultimately did not zero in on a specific proposal.
Was there a discussion that you saw where staff came in and basically said, no, we're not going to do that. This is the way it's going to be done now? And I saw that on the slide there, which had the language from, I think, Mr. Briggs' original letter that we saw earlier.
I would say that it's fair to say that our entire conversation was overshadowed by those five bullet points. There was probably some disagreement from the very beginning as to the appropriateness of those. I don't want to speak too much for other folks and speak too much out of school. Like I say, that process actually was quite productive for a time, and I thought very collegial. Just didn't end up going anywhere.
Okay, go ahead.
So we did go back to our respective corners, and we all submitted comments to the staff. They released a draft on February 1st, 2010, as you all know. We were pretty happy with that. We agreed with the provisions that they'd set forth, and we thought that they were consistent with the law. We had a hearing. It was actually a workshop in San Luis Obispo, and I apologize for this very small type. We learned from the staff that the revisions that they had proposed were necessary. Necessary to make the order legal and to make it comply with water quality requirements, which is why we're actually all here today. And I will just kind of read, the original order was intended to regulate discharges and ensure that such discharges are not causing or contributing to exceedances of water quality standards. What we learned from staff back in 2010 was that after 6 years, there was no direct evidence that water quality is improving due to the actual 2004 waiver. In fact, as we've seen time and time again, there have actually been conditions that have been getting worse in some places. For that reason, regional board staff, These fine people concluded that immediate and effective action was necessary to improve water quality protection and resolve the widespread and serious impacts on people and aquatic life. This was back in 2010. You had evidence before you suggesting that the existing order was not sufficient and it needed to be changed. However, in July of 2010, the board opted to allow for more discussion and consideration of the draft proposal and instead renewed the order for a second time. So we have two extensions of an order that at this time is already a year stale. So we go back, November 2010, we get a second draft from staff. In our opinion, it's not as good as the February one, but still goes a long way towards improving the 2004 order. However, that did not sit very well with some folks. So come March, we had a third draft. As has been presented by Ben and Steve, we found many problems with the third draft. It's just about unacceptable in our mind, although it still, in some ways, improves upon the 2004 order. As we've been seeing, it deteriorated in its strength from draft to draft. So the regional board, you all met in March. Unfortunately, there was no quorum, and you were unable to make a decision. That fault is not your own. I'm very happy to see that we do have a quorum now. Congratulations on your appointments. And this is all leading up to a plea for you all to act in March, now that you have your requisite decision-making authority. I will note that at the conclusion of March, after the first hearing was continued, we had a third extension of the 2004 order. May 2010, again, there was no quorum, so we had to continue the hearing. Here we come to September. We get another draft and another extension. Here's the fourth draft and the fourth extension. This brings us to today. So, as you saw earlier, since 2008, we've had at least three workshops. We've had a stakeholder panel. We've had several public hearings. We've had thousands of pages of comment. We've had time extensions. We've had new evidence. We've had consultation. We've had experts. We've had lovely presentations, but it hasn't necessarily gotten us anywhere. In March, the 2004 order will be almost 8 years old. By law, they can be no longer than 5 years. That means it's going to be at least 4 years overdue. We've been discussing this for 3 years. I find that juxtaposition fascinating. It's a five-year order, and we've been talking about it for 3 years. If you adopt something in March, we can talk about it for another 4 years and then adopt something else at the end of that road, and we'll be a lot better off than if you just keep talking about the same thing over and over again for an additional 5 years. I had a really tortured metaphor about credit and money. I'm going to throw that out the window. It's late. The problems are getting worse. The longer you delay, the worse they get. Ultimately, you're going to have to act. It's going to come at the behest of the state board. It's going to be the result of a lawsuit. There's going to be something that's going to compel action. The longer you wait, the harder it's going to be to do that and to fix any of the problems. Let's do something now. You've learned everything there is to learn. We don't need any more new information. What we need is action. If there are problems with what happens in March, we've got 4 years to figure it out. We can have another stakeholder process. We can get started early. We don't have to do this again. I don't think any of us want to do it again. It's fascinating. It's fantastic that you all have had the patience to sit here tonight for however many hours it's been. We'll do it again in March. Let's make it the last time. Because, again, we get to do it again before you even know it. So thank you all very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. You guys have a little less than 7 minutes. So if there's nothing else for you, we're going to keep that time. All right? Next group.